This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you a conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One, which features outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to the Day One Podcast Extra. This is Peter Wallace, and with me today is the Reverend Mike Kinman. Mike is this year's recipient of the John Hines Preaching Award, given by Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia. An Episcopal priest, Mike is the executive director of Episcopalians for Global Reconciliation, headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask first, what inspired you to write the sermon which won the John Hines Award?
In some ways, it's hard to remember because I wrote the sermon a while ago. And I really can't remember the exact process I went through. A lot of times when I'm preaching, what I will try to do as I'm sitting with the text and praying with the text and talking to other people is to try to lock on to some anchor, some image that will connect the text to something, to an experience, to something that people will have in their everyday life, so that when that experience comes up again, a trigger will go off in their head and it'll connect them back to the text. And I'm not sure what it was that did it for the eye contact thing this time, but that was, you know, I remember whenever I came up with that, that was one of those things. And I realized the next time someone's on a bus or the next time someone has an opportunity and makes that eye contact and looks away, hopefully it's going to trigger not so much my sermon, but trigger the scriptural text and get them to look at their action in a new way. I think at its best, what our preaching does is stay with people in a way that helps them reinterpret their lives in terms of scripture.
Well, what sorts of responses have you gotten from the sermon?
It's interesting. I mean, you know, of course, you know, you get sort of the nice sermon after the, you know, and sometimes that's actually a really disappointing response for me, particularly when they use the word nice, because I really didn't want it to be a nice sermon. The responses I got, said when we did this at the cathedral, actually had people get up and look at each other and really lock eyes with each other. And most of the response I got was about that experience and that it was difficult, but it was also in some ways very moving. And it was, you know, for some of them, it was locking eyes with people that they had been worshiping beside for decades, but had never had that experience with. You know, it's interesting. The congregation where I preach this is not a place where I'm on staff. And so I don't have the everyday kind of relationship with this congregation that I would if I were a priest at this congregation. What I would hope that a sermon like this could be is foundational for how are we treating each other? How are we reaching out into the community? You know, I'm always one, if someone says, wow, that was great, well, then I'm going to hold you to that. If you think that's a great idea, then let's continue to reframe our lives in terms of that text.
How did you get into the ministry? I know you were doing some campus ministry before your current...
How did I get into the ordained ministry? Or how did I get into EGR?
The ordained ministry.
Through a campus ministry. I went to college in Columbia, Missouri, and there was a great congregation, Calvary Church Columbia, that had a great college chaplain, a priest named Lance Robbins. There was a church and people and clergy that just made me feel at home and that really kind of grabbed me by the collar and said, you've got some gifts and this is where they need to be used. I was all set to be a sports writer.
Is that right?
I was going to journalism school to be a sports writer. And I realized with a lot of their help that this is really where I wanted to be and this is where I was being called.
And you moved into youth work.
Yeah, I helped with a great group of students plant a campus ministry at Washington University in St. Louis. I don't think there is a more fun job in the Episcopal Church than campus ministry. And I still get huge joy from those relationships. But it's actually, I do what I do today with Episcopalians for Global Reconciliation because of those students. It's their fault. Because they started traveling and they started going to places like Tanzania and Kenya and Haiti and doing this incredible work. And I, you know, they'd come back And I'd be encouraging them, but also something in me was like, wow, they're being changed and I want what they have. Mm. And then they called me on the fact that I was encouraging them to do something I'd never done myself. So I got a sabbatical and I went with one of my students to Ghana for 6 weeks. And then I went with two other students and our bishop to Sudan. And then I was hooked. And I just realized this is where God was drawing me. And probably my biggest enthusiasm for working with EGR and working with orienting the church towards global poverty is still working with youth and young adults, because the passion is just incredible. Mm. And the energy, particularly in this millennial generation, just I feed off it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the millennial generation? We read about how different they are in terms of engagement in the world and dealing with issues of poverty and need. What happened with them?
I think it's several things. First of all, I think this is a generation that very literally is wired differently. I have two sons, Schrader and Hayden, are 9 and 5 years old, mm-hmm. and I watch them growing up on computers. And, you know, literally when they're, you know, little and your brain chemistry, the brain, you know, the synapses, whatever, are still, you know, the electrical paths to your brains are being formed. I literally think they're forming differently based on these different experiences. And so I think you have a generation that is literally hardwired for relationship and interactivity in a way that, and I'm an Xer, that I wasn't. And, you know, I would have something called online office hours with my college students where I would just get on Instant Messenger and take conversations with them. And sometimes I'd have 4 or 5 conversations going at once. And I would, you know, after 2 hours, I would have a headache. And then I'd watch my students who would have 3 or 4 conversations going on at once. And they were studying and they were doing, I mean, they were multitasking and it was all relational. And so I think this is a... I think this is a compassionate generation, and I think there's a lot of – I think you have sort of the developmental stage of the idealism of youth, and that is meeting with this hunger for relationship and this sort of hardwiredness – that's not a word – for connectivity. And it's becoming really this perfect storm. And also there's opportunity. It's not just the internet. The opportunities for travel, for going to different places and again, literally making eye contact. And building relationship with people are there like they've never been before. And that's really what cements a commitment to working in communities of poverty. It's not looking at a statistic. I don't know anyone whose heart is strangely warmed by statistics. It's when you go into a community and you make a connection and you make a relationship, because then it doesn't become so much about, am I going to do some good? It's about, am I going to leave my friend hanging? Mm-hmm. Am I going to honor this relationship? And more people are able to do that now than ever before.
It's fascinating and very encouraging. And I wanted to ask you about EGR. As an organization, it focuses a good bit on the Millennium Development Goals, which most of our listeners have probably heard of, may be familiar with over the recent years. But they may not actually know what the goals are specifically. And I wonder if I could just ask you to comment on the 8 points that are on the agenda. The first is eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. That seems like such a huge task. What's happening in that area?
Frankly, many of the listeners may not have heard of the Millennium Development Goals. The Episcopal Church, it's amazingly enough, is sort of ahead of the curve on this. And most Americans have not heard of them. And they are these 8 goals that are to deal with the world's deepest brokenness. But really what they are is just a first step. And so sometimes those initial titles are a little misleading. If you look at the goals that are – if you look at the targets behind the first goal, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger – it really isn't about wiping it out completely. It is about by reducing the number of people who live on less than a dollar a day by half. Mm-hmm. And so it's by making a good first step. The truth is that for the first time in human history, we have the power to, you know, we've got the combination of the resources, the technology, and the delivery systems to end extreme poverty. We really can eradicate extreme poverty in our lifetimes. What the MDGs are about is getting that significant foothold. Mm-hmm. So the first one, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, that's about taking the number of people that 1.2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day and cutting that number in half by 2015. like most of the MDGs, we are falling behind on that one. We are not. We just passed the halfway point for the MDGs last summer, and we're nowhere close to halfway done. Some progress is being made. In some countries, more progress is being made than others. Sub-Saharan Africa continues to be the most dire need in all the world. And then you have situations, you have crisis situations happen, like the tsunami, like the like the earthquake, like the situation in Myanmar, that exacerbate conditions and destroy infrastructure. So,
second, achieve universal primary education.
That's probably the one that we are doing the best at. And that basically is removing the barriers so that every child has a full course of primary education. And that's probably the most doable of all these goals. The price tag for this, this is a great statistic, the price tag for doing that would be $10 billion a year, which that's a lot of money. I don't have it on me. We spend $20 billion a year on ice cream in this country. So for half of what we spend on ice cream, we could make sure that every child has a basic course of primary education. And there are whole countries that are very, very close to achieving this. But even that's just a first step, because I don't know who of us would say for our children, you know, my son can go through sixth grade, but then that's enough. It's the first step to that greater goal of us having all the education we need to be the people God calls us to be.
Third, promote gender equality and empower women.
If there's a silver bullet here, it's that one. The absolute best, fastest way to have economic development in a society, to have a society flourish, is empowering women. And that's almost simple math. You're taking half the population whose gifts are not being used and all of a sudden letting their gifts flourish. If you want to look for the first great MDG success story in sub-Saharan Africa, look at Rwanda. Rwanda is on the edge, is poised to just explode in a wonderful way. And one of the things Rwanda has done, Rwanda is the first nation to mandate that 50% of the seats in parliament get held by women.
Interesting.
And it's because they recognize that if they are going to not just survive but thrive as a nation, they need to use the gifts of all their people.
And then four and five, reduce child mortality and reduce maternal mortality.
And hopefully you've heard the statistic of a child dies every 3 seconds from preventable, treatable causes. It's actually getting a little better. But it's, again, it's one of these situations where there's still so much work to do. A huge cause of preventable child mortality is malaria. And the good thing about malaria is easy to prevent and it's easy to treat. It's a $5 bed net. It's a 50-cent dose of medication. It's all about the delivery systems and the support systems. And this is a place where the churches are really taking the lead. Our Episcopal Church has an amazing worldwide program called Nets for Life, which works with Christian Aid and Hope Africa. And it is not just for a church, but one of the best, if not the best, programs worldwide in terms of effectiveness of reducing malaria. But the problem is huge. I've been to a little speck of a village called Louis in southern Sudan. And when I was there, the under-5 mortality rate was close to 50%. You know, we went to a group from the Mothers Union and about 30 women there. And we asked, you know, raise your hand if you've lost a child to disease or the war. And every woman in the room raised her hand. This is a huge problem. Same thing with maternal mortality. For 1 in 16 women in sub-Saharan Africa, this is going to be the cause of death. For us as people of faith, I mean, one of the Ten Commandments is honor your father and mother. You know, we revere Mary, the mother of our Lord. Motherhood is central to our image of God's relationship with us. It is incumbent upon us as people of faith to make sure that motherhood is the safe, nurturing, life-giving experience as much as it can be for anybody.
Then number six, reverse the spread of HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases.
Right, and obviously there's some overlap here with the mortality issues. And this is, again, about doing something that the church has been always about, which is healing the sick.
Next, ensure environmentally sustainable development.
Right. A lot of the goals and markers in Goal 7 are about water. And so it is making sure that people have access to clean water. But it also brings up the point of reversing or at the very least slowing the effects of climate change. And the truth is, if we don't do something about climate change, we could meet all the markers and goals of the MDGs. By 2015, none of it would be sustainable because the effects of global warming and climate change continue to exacerbate the conditions. So as we do development, we have to make sure that it's environmentally sustainable or it's all going to be for naught.
And then the final one, build global partnerships for development.
And that's about how we get all the rest of them done. And it's sort of the great opportunity that we have. But it's more than about us working together. It's acknowledging that there are systemic issues like trade issues, like aid issues, like debt issues, that we need to work together to change the systems that keep people in poverty. It isn't enough for me just to sponsor a child to go to school. That's a wonderful thing. It's about me going to my leaders in Washington and saying debt forgiveness is essential. Fair trade is essential. We need to have policies like, we need to have a farm bill. We need to have agriculture policies that don't dump huge amounts of surplus commodity on the world market, that depress prices so that a poor farmer in Ghana can't get a decent price for his crop and feed himself and his family. Again, it's about recognizing the power that we have with the economic choices we make, the power that we have with the political choices we make.
And all of these goals relate to Christ's command, as you preached in your sermon on day one, to engage with the needy. Say something about how the gospel is exercised through these working in these areas.
And it is through relationship. And I think there, and this is one of the gifts that the church has to bring, is that we tend to operate on sort of a baseline economic and almost medical model of development, which is here's the problem, and I am going to be the person who comes in and fixes it. It's almost mathematical that way. This is not the Christian economy. The Christian economy is Jesus saying, as you do to these, so you do to me. Which means we are going into these places. And you know, I use the image of we need to take our shoes off because we're walking on the sacred ground of people's lives. What the church can bring to this process is recognizing that we're not going to these powerless, ungifted people that are pure brokenness that needs to be fixed. We are going into communities of incredibly gifted people, people who are every bit as much an image of God as you or I are. We are going literally to seek Christ there and then invite us all to put all our gifts on the table and say together, how can we live together in a way that we flourish? And actually, if you look at best practices of development, that's what it is. It's not about top-down systems that are saying, we're going to give you all this aid, we're going to give you all this stuff, and we're going to create these cultures of dependency. It is about freeing people up to be the images of God that they already are. And recognizing that a lot of the answers exist in the community. They just need to be brought up. And so I think particularly as Americans, when we need to train our attention globally. But the first thing we need to do when we do that is to listen.
Mike Kinman, wonderful food for thought, prayer, and action. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.